All right, good morning, everyone. I hope everyone has had a wonderful, relaxing weekend. Today, I'm going to upload the previous year, midterm exam and answer key on our course website. So this is the first one, and the next week will be another one. So this will give you an idea of what type of questions you would expect to see in our upcoming midterm on November 5th. All right, so today we're going to continue our discussion of how you can regulate chromatin to regulate gene expression. And at the lecture on Friday, we end up talking about this recruitment by a sequence-specific transcription factor of HAT enzyme complex. HAT stands for histone acetyltransferase complex, to the vicinity of the promoter region so that there will be a covalent modification. In this case, is hyperacetylation, which will relax the grip of histone N-terminal termini on the DNA double helix so that you will have a relaxed chromatin structure. This will eventually lead to increased transcription activation. The HAT enzyme comes in a multi-subunit complex, and the catalytic activity resides in a protein called GCN5. So it is this GCN5 that has this histone acetyltransferase activity to transfer acetyl group from acetyl-CoA to the lysine residues at the N-termini of the histone molecules. So if you think that this would increase transcription by relaxing chromatin structure, the reverse should be also true. To suppress transcription by introducing a more compact chromatin structure. Indeed, people actually found just the opposite of this picture. What you see over here is another factor. This time, it's not the transcription activator. Instead, it's a sequence-specific transcription repressor. RD stands for repression domain. Once again, DBD stands for DNA binding domain. So this protein, once again, has a modular structure. You can at least see two different domains, DNA binding domain, repression domain. And this protein can bind to upstream promoter elements. This is called URS1. R stands for repressive. So it's a opposite of a UAS, which is upstream activating sequence. This is an upstream repressive sequence number one. So UME6 is a sequence-specific transcription repressor. It binds to this element, and then it can also make contact with a multi-subunit protein complex. This time, this multi-subunit complex is just the opposite of a HAT complex. Instead of adding acetyl tails to histone termini, this guy can actually come in to remove the acetyl groups from the histone N-termini. So the enzyme for this activity is called histone deacetylase complex, or HDAC activity. I mean, this is actually a complex. Once again, the catalytic activity resides in one subunit of this complex called RPD3. Okay? There is another famous subunit called SYN3 because this subunit makes a direct contact with UME6 through the repression domain. So basically, through protein-protein interaction between UME6 and SYN3, this big multi-subunit HDAC complex, histone deacetylase complex, is recruited to the vicinity of the binding site, which now can remove this acetyl groups. So now you can see that the neighboring nucleosomes no longer have the acetyl groups on the histone N-termini. This will once again introduce the positive charge to the lysine residues, and then those positive charge lysine residues will allow histone N-termini to bind very tightly to the negative charged sugar phosphate backbone of your DNA, which is still wrapping around the histone octamer, which will result in a highly condensed, highly compact chromatin structure in the neighborhood. This obviously will prevent transcription, as we have already discussed last time. So this is just the opposite of what we just saw. Through removing the histone N-termini, removing the acetyl groups from histone N-termini, you can achieve transcription repression by hyperacetylating histone N-termini you can achieve transcription activation. So this is just, you know, very interesting ticking tack, you know, type of situation. When we talk about modification, covalent modification of histones, it turns out that the acetylation or deacetylation is only one of the many examples. If you look at a histone residue, you realize that actually many, many residues, such as this histone H3, okay, can be covalently modified. This illustrates actually only a partial list. Every day there's new revelation about which residue can be modified, what its meaning is, and what kind of biological function the modification does to gene expression. But this was essentially a diagram, you know, I obtained from a textbook maybe a year ago or 2 years ago. So this only represents the knowledge up to that point. We have even new identifications identify the residues these days. But anyway, if we just look at this, we can see that even for a single histone H3 protein, there are many, many sites in the N-terminal region of this molecule that can be covalently modified. You can count M stands for methylation. Even for methylation, there will be subtle difference. It could be monomethylation, dimethylation, trimethylation, because each lysine can be modified three times with three acetyl groups. So there are a lot of subtlety, a lot of difference over here. A, of course, is acetylation. And P is for phosphorylation. So you can see there are a lot of residues that can be methylated, acetylated, phosphorylated. And there are also other types of modifications which is not drawn over here, such as monoubiquination and so on and so forth. So through genetic biochemical analysis, people actually began to understand what kind of biological functions those modifications have. What kind of biological impact those modifications have on gene expression. Here lists a partial understanding of some of the modification states that people have observed, very famous ones, and their respective biological meanings. Okay? For example, we've already seen that acetylation of H3K9 is usually associated with gene expression. Very often this goes together with methylation at K4. So K4 methylation and K9 acetylation is usually associated with activation of gene expression. Same thing true for serine phosphorylation on serine number 10 and then associated with acetylation on K14. This is also associated with gene expression. Conversely, you can see that there's methylation on K9, which is very often associated with heterochromatin formation or gene silencing. Okay? Methylation of K9, at the same residue of K9, if you acetylate it, you can have active gene expression, but if you methylate it, you can have gene silencing or heterochromatin formation. Same thing true for this. This is a methylation on K27. It has a very specific meaning. It's important for silencing of Hox genes, which are important for development, mammalian cell development. And it's also important for X chromosome inactivation. So you can see that there are lots of modifications, number one, the take-home lesson, number one. Number two, they can work in different combinations to give you what we call histone modification code. Essentially, they are giving you a code because modifications can go in different combinations, will give different meanings. This is a partial list of what kind of modifications or combinations that you often encounter and their biological meanings. So they are often associated with either increased transcription or gene silencing. Some occur in very general fashion like this one. Some occur in very specific fashion for example, only silencing of Hox genes or some other related genes. Or X chromosome inactivation. Yes, you have a question.
Yes, for the acetylation,
yeah.
You know what you neutralize the charge.
Yes, yeah.
You know, make this chromosome more accessible.
That's right.
So we know how this methylation.
Yes, as I know. As I said last time, actually, we actually don't know the biophysical underlying for the reason why, for example, methylation. This modification itself would actually lead to gene silencing or heterochromatin. But on a slide, you will see several slides from now, you will see that actually the methylation can actually serve as a platform for other factors to come in to create a heterochromatin domain. So this is not directly related to the chemical nature of methylation or something, unlike what we see about acetylation of H3K9 or something like that. Okay. So this is, but you know, don't forget that we also have histone H2A, H2B, H4. They also come with their unique modification patterns. All of those contribute to a very elaborate code. Essentially, it's a secret code, and cells have different machinery to decode the meaning from those modification combinations and give out the important, interesting, varying biological readout. Okay. So I want to say a few more things about this particular residue. We have seen that this H3K9 can be acetylated, can also be deacetylated, can also be methylated. How can you imagine a one single amino acid in one single histone molecule can actually contribute to gene regulation to such a great extent? For this, we have to take a look at the next slide. Actually, for the modification changes of a single residue, like H3K9, lysine number 9, you need actually concerted actions of multiple histone modifying enzymes in order to regulate the gene expression. Let's take a look at two different situations. One is this derepressed open state, so usually referring to euchromatin state, ready for true activation, we already mentioned last time. This is associated with hyperacetylation of H3K9. In order to get to this state, of course, you need to have a HAT enzyme to transfer acetyl group to this residue. But the opposite, or the in contrast to the acetylation of H3K9, we just saw that this residue could also be methylated. ME3 stands for trimethylation at this residue. So this residue could also be methylated, and the methylation of the same residue is associated with inactive, highly condensed state of chromatin, usually what we call a heterochromatin. Okay? So how do you convert from this heterochromatin state with trimethylation of K9 to the acetylation of K9, which is associated with derepressed open state? You need two enzymes, as indicated over here. You need to have first a histone lysine demethylase to remove the trimethyl groups from K9. That's the first step. And you also need a concerted action working at the same time, the HAT, to put the acetyl group on the same residue. And now you achieved the derepressed open state. Reverse. You look at the opposite. In order to make this from derepressed open state to inactive condensed state, you need to use HDAC, histone deacetylase complex, to remove the acetyl group first. And then at the same time, you need to have a histone methyltransferase, HMT, to put the methyl group on the same residue. So you look at this same residue, it can be regulated by four different enzymes, okay, which will achieve either a derepressed open state or highly condensed inactive state. So it requires concerted actions of multiple histone modifying enzymes in gene regulation. So this is just looking at one single residue. You can imagine that with so many potential modification sites, there are a lot of combinations, a lot of possibilities for different enzymes, either acetyltransferase or deacetylase or kinase in the case of phosphorylation, or methylase or demethylase, in order to work together to give you the different combinations, the different code to be read out by the cell. So it's a very, very complicated situation. This, by the way, is really the current, the cutting edge of our understanding of gene regulation, because as you know that whether you're looking at the specific gene regulation in certain developmental pathways or even X chromosome or some other disease process, you cannot separate yourself from the basic understanding of chromatin modification state. They really lie at the fundamental, it's quite important for understanding of those biological processes such as development and the disease. All right, so this, you know, we can only essentially scratch the surface of what we are currently aware of, the complexity of histone modification. But we actually run out of time, so what I'm going to do next is to look at the other side of the coin. Remember, I told you that you can activate chromatin not only by introducing covalent modifications of histones, you can also introduce so-called chromatin remodeling factors. Okay? Those factors can be recruited once again by sequence-specific transcription binding, you know, by sequence-specific transcription factor, whether this is a transcription activator. Usually we are referring to activator because we want to remodel chromatin to achieve transcription activation. So the sequence-specific transcription activator make a first contact with the cognate DNA sequence, and then could also recruit the chromatin remodeling factors, okay, to change the local chromatin structure by move nucleosomes away or, you know, reorganize to stimulate transcription from the chromatin template. So in a sense, those chromatin remodeling factors, just like those histone modifying enzymes, can be considered as a type of co-activators because they help your transcription activators. They help your sequence-specific transcription activators. So they are also called co-activators to stimulate transcription from chromatin template. Okay? There are quite several different flavors of chromatin remodeling complex identified or studied up to date. And some of those originally identified in yeast and subsequently the human homologs, such as the yeast originally is called yeast switch sniff complex, and then subsequently the human homolog called human switch sniff complex, and then the human ACF, RSF, etc. Those have been gradually identified and characterized in great detail. Without exception, all chromatin remodeling complexes in eukaryotic cells contain a common subunit, which is a helicase ATPase component. And this enzymatic activity is important to disrupt interactions between nucleic acids or interactions between nucleic acid and protein. So obviously those will greatly help the movement of nucleosomes or remodeling of chromatin. Okay? The yeast switch sniff complex is the first identified, and it's the best studied. People have done a lot of biochemical genetic analysis of its function and to try to understand how it actually modify chromatin structure. It turns out that it uses ATP and uses its helicase ATPase component to hydrolyze ATP and get energy to do some magic tricks. The tricks that it does is to transiently allow the DNA to dislocate transiently from the histone octamer and then allow the nucleosome to slide along the DNA. It's a little bit difficult to imagine exactly how this works. But just imagine that somehow this enzyme uses ATP, uses its ATPase and the helicase activity, somehow can introduce So this will allow the nucleosome somehow to slide along the DNA. I want to, before we look at the next slide, I want to point out that the chromatin remodeling complex is not just designed for transcription regulation. You can imagine any biological events that take place on chromatin at the chromatin level, such as repair, recombination, and replication could also take advantage of the activities of those chromatin remodeling complexes. So how do we imagine, how do we envision this kind of magic tricks introduced by the histone remodeling complex? people are still studying this. You know, they don't have an absolute idea exactly how this works, but the end result is very easy to measure. For example, if you have a piece of radioactive labeled DNA, you put the P30 label at the beginning of it, and you can study the phasing of nucleosome on this piece of DNA. You may actually see that nucleosome initially binds to one end of DNA, okay? But after you throw in your histone remodeling complex in the presence of ATP, you can actually see sliding of the nucleosome from the end now to the middle of the piece of DNA, which you can actually measure. You can actually detect easily by a couple of different biochemical methods. One way to look at this is to use a method so-called the altered restriction enzyme access. And this slide also shows you what I just said, you know, a transient dislocation of DNA. So imagine that you begin with a nucleosome array like this. There are two cutting sites by restriction enzyme A and B, because the DNA sequence corresponding to site initially is tightly wrapped around a nucleosome. So this makes the cleavage by your restriction enzyme A very difficult. So there's no cutting by the enzyme A. However, the site B happens to be in the linker region between two nucleosomes. So if you throw in your restriction enzyme B, you can make a perfect cut. All right? So that's the initial beginning state. After you throw in your remodeling complex plus ATP, you can have one of the two situations. In both cases, you see a change of the accessibility to cleavage by your restriction enzyme A or B. For example, on the left side, you can have a sliding. Okay, so the nucleosome now is moving closer to the next two. And now the A site is becoming in the linker region, and then it becomes accessible to cleavage by restriction enzyme A. On the other hand, the B site now is actually tightly wrapped around this nucleosome. It's no longer accessible. So by throwing restriction enzyme B, you don't have a cut. So by seeing an obvious change from the distribution of cleavage site of A and B on this piece of DNA, from this pattern to this pattern, you know something has happened, because what you throw in is a remodeling complex and ATP. You know there must be a sliding. But on the other hand, the situation could be also like this. And this is what I call the transient dislocation. You can see that the DNA, for some reason, transiently dissociated from the surface of a nucleosome octamer from the ball. It's not tightly wrapped around this. Instead, there's a little bump over here, and somehow this will allow the nucleosome to slide with the help of remodeling complex ATP. But in this case, you can also see that there is a change of cleavage by enzyme A and B, because A now becomes accessible because it's in this transiently dislocated small loop region, becomes accessible, whereas B is now becoming tightly wrapped around the nucleosome. Now you see inaccessibility to this site by restriction enzyme B. So by measuring the altered restriction enzyme access in the presence of a remodeling complex and ATP, you have a way to analyze the shift phasing pattern of nucleosomes. It's a little bit abstract, but I just want to give you this overall idea that the remodeling complex can do this kind of trick, which can be measured in a test tube by a very simple biochemical assay like this. That's all you want to know. But overall, this process, you know, the ATP-dependent, the chromatin remodeling complex, obviously contributes to gene activation, just like the modification of histones. Yes, you have.
When they do the experiment in
vitro, yeah.
Does it always slide to the same place?
No, it does not always slide to the same place. It could be, well, I guess depending on the intrinsic activity of the remodeling complex, also depend on intrinsic DNA sequence of this piece of DNA. It's not random, but it's all the behavior determined by the components themselves. We cannot decide, but we can measure it. We can detect whether there's a change, for example, using this method. Yes? Yeah, I would imagine that you could have a situation if the A and B are fairly separate from each other, and maybe the nucleosome somehow is moving in the middle of it, and then the A and B happens to be both in the linker region, yes, you will have accessibility of both sides. So this is just illustrates one hypothetical situation. What you want to see is change. Any change, like President Obama introduced changes, we want to see changes, right? So it doesn't matter what kind of change, you know, either change, but if you see a change in the presence of your modifying complex and ATP, you know there's something happening by the activity thrown into the reaction. That's all you want to know. So we have talked about all of this, and how do we put this in the context of gene regulation? This is the context. It's quite complicated. I have to say that this is also gene-specific. So if we look at a specific gene, if it happens to be in the beginning state of a highly condensed heterochromatin state, how do we eventually get this gene activated? Let's just trace the sequence of events that will eventually lead to the activation of this particular gene. We can have, as I said, some of the sequence-specific gene activator proteins have incredible high affinity. They can bind to the target site even when this binding site, this enhancer or promoter proximal element is in a highly condensed chromatin state. This factor can bind, but that's wonderful. This gains a strong foothold to lead to a chain of events. So this factor will bind and then will attract, for example, in this case, chromatin remodeling complex to this chromatin region, which will do the tricks of chromatin remodeling in the presence of ATP. And then this will actually relax the chromatin structure a little bit, just enough to allow the second important enzyme to come in. In this case, is a histone modification enzyme, such as HAT. Okay, and this enzyme can now further can modify histones and can further relax the chromatin structure. Now we are ready to present additional binding sites for other transcription activators to bind in. Those are still sequence-specific transcription factors. They bind in, and they can also recruit additional factors, one of which is very, very important. I'll go into some details on the next slide, is called the mediator. And this guy is just like the name implies. It's a mediator in between your sequence-specific transcription activators and the general transcription factor machinery, the PIC complex. And those factors would also recruit, of course, general transcription factors, RNA polymerase II. Then we can assemble a pre-initiation complex at the promoter region. That's not the end of the story, because at this moment, you still need to have sufficient changes within the pre-initiation complex. So this will involve perhaps additional gene activator proteins to come in, which will also involve rearrangement of proteins in the pre-initiation complex to make everybody at the right position with the right distance away from the polymerase, with the right relative distance from the transcription start site, so on and so forth. After all of this, we can talk about transcription initiation. So it's a very, very complicated, a whole chain of events, usually begin with a sequence-specific transcription factor binding, and then getting either a modifying enzyme or chromatin remodeling complex, or in this case, both of them, to the same gene promoter. And then you can recruit additional factors, such as mediators, such as other general transcription TF factors and RNA polymerase II. Eventually involves a rearrangement of all the components in the complex. Everything has to make proper contact with each other in order to have transcription initiation takes place. And also emphasize this specific order difference from one gene to the next. So don't call this as a general theme for all genes that are activated by, you know, whatever signals. This is only specific to this particular gene. If you switch to a different gene, it may go a completely different order. Instead of having a chromatin remodeling complex coming first, it may actually have the histone acetylation complex or some kind of a methylation complex coming first. Sometimes it doesn't even require chromatin remodeling factor at all. But anyway, more or less, they involve this many different events. Okay, and they involve a whole bunch of transcriptional co-activators and the mediator. All right, I want to say a few more words about this mediator because it's so important to for our understanding of transcription activation, particularly tissue-specific or cell-type-specific activation of gene expression, as you will see on the next slide. So once again, we begin with condensed chromatin. We end up having a decondensed chromatin. Our final achieved goal is to form a stable activated initiation complex so that our RNA polymerase can start to make RNA. Okay, that's our final goal. In order to achieve this final activated initiation complex, as you can see, of course, you need to have this sequence-specific transcription activators binding to the enhancer, promoter, proximal regions. They also have to make contact with your mediator. Of course, before we have those the setup, you already have those histone modification enzymes and chromatin remodeling factors. They've already come in to give you the relaxed, the decondensed chromatin in the first place. But after that, you can see that you need to have this highly coordinated assembly of a transcription initiation factor complex consisting of the green activation domains of those DNA sequence-specific transcription factors making simultaneous cooperative contact with this common big blob we call mediator. Okay? What is shown over here is just a big blob, but you understand this is actually composed of many subunits. Okay? I forgot the exact number, around 13 or 15 subunits. It's quite big. And this media complex has many surface areas because it comes in very big size with many components. They can allow the interaction of those gene-specific factors with the same common mediator so that they can make a crosstalk, you know, transfer the information from the gene activators eventually to our general transcription factors and RNA polymerase II, which is at the core promoter region. Okay, there are a lot of rearrangements of protein components. Everybody has to make proper interaction. Everybody has to be at the right position. And then eventually, we can have a transcription activation takes place. So I emphasize that you need to set up this coordinated, stable, activated initiation complex. If you're missing just one of them or two of them, very often the consequence is no activation at all. Okay? You need to have this complex assembled properly. All the interactions, all the binding surface, you know, making proper contact among all the components in order to have this transcription initiation to take place. Illustration of this point comes on the next slide. Okay, this is actually a very interesting idea. So you can imagine that you have, you know, we all have 23 pairs of chromosomes. We all have exact same genes in all of our cell types. Well, how come certain genes are only transcribed in your liver cells, but not in your kidney cells or intestine cells or brain cells? What is the fundamental difference between the tissue-specific or cell-type-specific activation of a given gene? This illustrates our understanding of this point. Okay? So if we look at a specific example of a gene called TTR for transthyretin gene, this is a gene, this is a protein that can bind to thyroid hormone in your blood serum so that it carries this hormone to the proper space. Okay? This gene is transcribed in liver cells, and this protein is produced by your liver cells so that it can go into your blood and then carry the thyroid hormone to the proper location for the proper function of your body, for the proper development, you know, when you age. So if you look at this particular gene, it's quite complicated. It has several enhancer elements located, about 2 kb away from the transcription start site. In addition, has also quite a few so-called promoter proximal elements. Remember, those are usually located within the 200 base pair from the TALA box from the transcription start site.
if you look at those promoter elements, promoter proximal elements, enhancer elements, you can actually tell they are binding sites for a variety of transcription activators, which are listed in this table over here. Okay. Interestingly, your liver cells actually has a whole collection of five different factors that will bind to the promoter region, the enhancer region, or promoter proximal region of this gene, TTR gene. In other cell types, such as intestine cells or kidney cells, you are missing these two factors, HNF1 and HNF3, which are only expressed in liver cells. Those three factors are expressed ubiquitously in many other cell types, including kidney cells and intestine cells. But the kidney cells don't have these two factors. All right? So you can imagine that when an initiation complex is set up on this promoter, okay, in liver cells, you can imagine that all the factors can find their proper targets to make proper contacts with the mediator and the general transcription, the PIC complex, and RNA polymerase II. However, in kidney cells and liver cells, you could be missing those three, or you could be missing these two. So you still have some contact, okay, between the mediator and those other additional ubiquitous factors, but that's not enough. It does not form a stable activator initiation complex that does not lead to the final activation of transcription. And we think that's the reason for the gene-specific, or for the tissue-specific regulation of this gene. Yes, there are several questions.
So on the past slide, you were yes. talking about, when we discussed how enhancers are position-oriented, distance and orientation independent.
That's right.
It seems like if the top sequence there is supposed to represent an enhancer sequence uh-huh. into activators, that there are some constraints on where enhancers can be. They can't be too close, otherwise the DNA folding wouldn't work right and they wouldn't be able to bind to the mediator complex.
Yeah, they cannot be too close. The DNA becomes highly rigid when it's smaller than about 100 base pairs. So this thing can be still very far away. As long as they can allow the DNA to loop out properly, they can make proper contact with the mediator and the general transcription machinery. You should be able to have a very good activation. What is important is to count the total number of contacts, all right? So essentially, in liver cells, you have all the contact surface occupied. You can have this active initiation complex assembly. Whereas in other cell types, such as kidney cells or intestine cells, you have only a small number, insufficient numbers of contacts. That does not lead to this assembly of a complex. Yes?
I just
wonder,
in the next slide.
Yes.
So for the HNF1 and HNF3,
yes.
It's
only in liver cells.
Whereas the other one expressed in
many other cells. Yes.
So my question is, what controls that HLF1?
I know. That's a chicken egg issue. I cannot answer this question. So this traces back to how the developmental decision is made initially in a stem cell, and why would certain genes be turned on? They go this developmental pathway in a irreversible manner. So somehow at certain stages during the liver development, you have those genes already turned on, and those genes already turned off in liver cells, which contribute to this. But I cannot answer that question. Sorry. It's not just me I cannot answer the question. Other people also cannot answer this question at this moment. It's very complicated. Yeah. All right. So the other question, interesting question about the enhancer function, I already told you, just mentioned, is the position, orientation, and what is the distance independent manner of enhancers. But you may have a question when I mention those interesting characteristics of enhancers. For example, if an enhancer is 50 kb away, which is a very long distance from a gene promoter it's supposed to regulate, but on the other hand, there might be another gene only 5 kb away from that enhancer. So how can this enhancer only regulates the gene which is 550 kb away, but not somebody else, which is only 5 kb away, on the same piece of DNA. What controls this enhancer specificity? That's a very interesting question if you think about it. It's a very important question to be addressed in many processes such as development and disease. It turns out the answer is quite simple. Okay? Enhancers have to function in a gene-specific fashion because there are those building walls in the chromatin structure. They are called boundary or insulator elements, as indicated by this kind of like a stop sign type of shape. So this will create local domains of a chromatin so that your enhancer, as indicated by this different colored oval shape, can only activate a promoter within this boundary. Okay? It cannot go across the boundary, even though, despite the fact this promoter seems to be closer to this enhancer than this promoter. So this enhancer cannot cross the boundary, cannot activate this gene. This gives you the enhancer specific or gene specific function of enhancer. All right? And how does this work? How does the boundary insulator elements work? Once again, this is also another cutting edge area of research. People know a little bit, but still not much. It has something to do with a protein factor called CTCF. Okay, it's a non-histone protein, and this protein can interact with those boundary insulator elements, can recruit additional factors such as those factors involving heterochromatin formation or so on and so forth, so that they give you a wall, like a firewall. You know, you use internet all the time, and basically you guys can all share the same UC Berkeley, Bearfax, whatever, the wireless network. But you cannot see his computer stuff. He cannot see your stuff because there are firewalls. You can only work on your own. You cannot steal information from your neighbors. So essentially this serves as the same firewall type of situation. Yes?
If that's the case, so let's say you leave that boundary.
Yes. Yes. Of course, that's right. Yes, so this is very important. You cannot delete those, otherwise you will have those non-specific activation of random, gene promoters. The insulator element has another function, and I don't know whether I should go into this, but this is quite self-exemplary. You should be able to read this yourself. Basically, the boundary element is also important to prevent so-called spreading of silenced heterochromatin. This slide also shows you how the trimethylation of H3K9 methylation, ME3 is the trimethylation, how this type of modification can contribute to the formation of heterochromatin with the help of a factor called HP1. So I'll just leave it like this, and you guys can look at this yourself. Not difficult at all, but this is another function of a boundary or insulator element. All right, we have talked about two different types of methods to analyze DNA protein interaction. One is called DNase1 footprinting. The other one is called MSI for gel shift, gel mobility shift, in short. Okay, both methods are used to analyze DNA protein interaction in test tube, in vitro. Today, I'm going to introduce another method to study DNA protein interaction, but this is done in living cells. And this method is called chromatin immunoprecipitation, or CHIP. Has this been described by Professor Albert? No? Not yet. All right, great. So, once again, this allows you to study the interaction of a factor you're interested in, such as SP1, such as TF2D, such as RNA polymerase, such as some other factors, or such as HAT enzyme, or whatever, you name it. You can study this in living cells to study how it binds, where it binds, all right? So this method is called chromatin immunoprecipitation. Obviously, it's related to chromatin. Obviously, it uses antibody. Otherwise, you cannot call it chromatin immunoprecipitation. Suppose you are interested in finding out the purple shaped factors to find out where it binds on this chromatin template. Okay? You have antibodies to recognize this purple protein. That's great. Right? Without antibody, you cannot do this. The first thing you do is to do a so-called cross-linking. Okay? You use a chemical compound called formaldehyde. As you know, formaldehyde can cross-link proteins. Okay? You want to fix everything to the DNA, also the protein get cross-linked at the same time. And you add this compound to your living cells. So it will penetrate through the cell membrane. It will, you know, just basically freeze everything at that very instant. Okay? So now you have proteins, including your purple proteins, now cross-linked to the chromatin DNA. What you do next is to use a physical method to shear up the chromatin. This is usually done by sonication, ultrasound, which will shear this chromatin into small fragments. And you have to do a pilot experiment to make sure that you don't overdo it. You know, you don't do too much to make it too small. Or you also want to make sure that you don't do too lightly so that your chromatin will be too big, and that's not going to work. Usually, you shear up the chromatin to the average size about the 500, 600, 700 base pairs in that kind of range. So you have to do some kind of a pilot experiment because the energy output of a sonicator varies from machine to machine. So for each new machine, you have to do your own adjustment. You have to do your own measurement. But suppose you have done the sonication nicely, and now you have an average size of 600 base pair fragment. That's wonderful. The next thing you do is to add the antibody, which will recognize the purple protein, which is now still frozen on the chromatin DNA. Okay, and you use antibody, which is not drawn over here. The antibody is attached to a bead, such as agarose or sucralose or whatever, which is commercially available. So then you do a so-called immunoprecipitation. The idea is to use the antibody to catch the antigen and then precipitate down to the bottom of the tube using the bead, because bead is quite big. It's heavy, so you centrifuge it, and it comes down to the bottom of the tube. So now you can see that your antibody has brought down the purple protein, still bind to this piece of DNA. The next step you do is to do a reversal of crosslinks, and the name sounds very complicated, sophisticated, but in reality, it's very simple. You just heat up your sample at 65 degrees overnight. The next morning, the cross-link bonds get reversed, get hydrolyzed. Okay, so now you have your purple protein and its DNA separated. From this moment on, you are no longer interested in the purple protein. Instead, you are interested in this piece of DNA because you want to find out exactly where this DNA lies on the original piece of chromatin template. Okay, so now you are only interested in this piece of DNA. How can you find out where this DNA is on the original piece of a chromatin template? What you do is to do a PCR reaction. Okay, you can design several sets of PCR primers, as indicated by this the opposite direction arrow. So this is one set of primer, this is a second set of primer, this is a third set of primer, this is a fourth, fifth set of primer. And you do your PCR reaction by throwing this released DNA fragment into your reaction as a template. Okay? After PCR reaction, as you can see that, because in reaction number one, you don't have the template, so there's no amplification as indicated by the negative sign. In reaction number two, since you don't have DNA template, there's still no amplification. Only in reaction number three, since you have thrown in this purified DNA, which is initially bound by your purple protein, now this DNA will be amplified. You have a plus sign. So by looking at the plus sign, minus sign of the set of your PCR reaction, you can tell where your purple protein originally binds. So this is the idea behind this chip method. It's incredibly powerful these days. Literally everybody uses in molecular biology field. And there are interesting variations and very complicated modifications of this this technique. This can be coupled to high throughput sequencing. So you can map the whole genome by looking at the genome browser to find out exactly where your protein binds. And this can be also connected to DNA microarray, so-called chip method. So, lots of variations. So the fundamental original idea is over here. So next time I'll show you a specific experimental example to see how we can use this method.